Hello and welcome to the Coast to Coast College Admissions Podcast. Each week, we talk about different college admissions topics and answer those tough questions you may be dealing with concerning getting into the college of your choice. We know how difficult this process can be, so each week, we try and make it easier to navigate. Now, here's your host, Anna Wren and Mark Huffer.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Coast to Coast College Admissions Podcast. I'm your host, Anna Wren, and here with me is...
Mark Huffer. Woohoo!
Yay! Oh, it's so exciting. So, Mark, what are we talking about today?
Oh, boy. We're talking about developing, and this is a timely thing. It sounds early, but it's not. Developing your college list and why it matters.
Yes, absolutely. And it's not just for rising seniors either. So I want to put that out there.
Absolutely. That's one of the things I think you can, we deal with this every day, we realize that it, you know, you can start as early as you want on identifying schools that have some of the things that you're looking for. But I think for those juniors who are looking at the calendar and dates on the calendar are always closer than they appear, I think they are noticing that the sooner they can start identifying some colleges to visit and some colleges to start focusing their applications to, now is the time.
So how do we figure out, how do we help guide these people on how to get started if they're starting at the starting line?
Yeah, it's one of the things I think since we both do this and we also know a lot of educational consultants who do this for many thousands of students, I think everybody has a slightly different avenue to finding, you know, that initial list. And I think generating them is different for everybody, and some people have lots of different ways to do it. I think some of the ways that I've come up with are directly identifying why students really want to go to college in the first place. And I think that's where I start. Why do you want to go to college? Because if they can answer that, I think coming up with a college list is so much easier. Otherwise, you're throwing darts at a dart.
What a great point you raise. And I've actually asked that question before. And I was like saying, you can't say because mom and dad told me I have to. That's not going to fly.
Exactly. I think I ask them, why do you want to go to college? If you can answer that authentically and personally, and like you say, because mom and dad want me to, is not one of the best reasons to go, although it may be one. And then I also challenge students, and I've said this in previous podcasts, I ask them, what are four things you either want to learn or know when you walk across the stage after 4 years of college? And I think if you can start those as targets, you can start identifying colleges that will help you satisfy those four things and why you're going to college.
That's a great way of putting it. So once they identify the most important factors for them, what are like some factors you think or you put out there for students? Because I know I run through this activity where we break it down by different things and I ask them all these different questions. But what are some of the different factors you use with your kids?
Well, that's one of the interesting things. I don't know if you've noticed this with the students that you work with, but there is no one set way of putting a hierarchy on what the most important things that a student wants in a college, like which characteristics. Because, I mean, size may be the biggest thing for somebody, and no pun intended, but it may be where it's located. Some kids only want to go to California, or they only want to go to Alaska. Okay, I've never heard anybody who only wants to go to Alaska, but... So it really, the list of things that I use, I try not to put them in my own mind as hierarchical, but I think there are probably 10 or 11 that I generally use. I think the most important ones and the most common ones are size, geographical location, what kind of programs are offered so that they're in the majors and the areas of academics they want to study, cost. Is always and increasingly so an important metric. And then admission selectivity, which is basically who's getting in and what kind of metrics, numbers do they have, what kind of GPA and what kind of SAT or ACT scores they have. How about you?
I always ask those questions too. And we do talk about setting as well, in addition to size and location. So I have some students, for example, that really have a specific major in mind. And as a result, they want to make sure that there are plentiful internship opportunities, or they want to be able to intern during the school year. So, you know, they might say to me, oh, I really want to be in a city. So that'll help narrow it down a little bit.
Absolutely.
But some students really love the outdoors. So I've had a student who's like, I really enjoy hiking and rock climbing. And so that narrows down the list quite a bit as well, you know. So little things like that where, you know, I think that they go beyond the size and the programs. And, you know, in terms of when you bring up cost, I feel like sometimes my students don't think about cost. But I think it's an important conversation that needs to be had within the family, between parents and the child, to understand, well, what does that mean, you know, and cost, and how much, or the parents feel comfortable helping to pay.
Yeah, one thing with cost, I don't know if you've started doing this as well. I think we've talked about it previously, but one of the things to start long-range planning, a lot of times people are looking at going into graduate school. And so the idea of cost as a factor of, you want to graduate with as little debt as possible so that your graduate school is even a possibility. If you graduate with too much debt, that opportunity may go away with too much of a debt.
That's a great point. And I think along those lines, I've had students that pick specific programs with that in mind. So for example, if they want an MBA, they will apply for like accelerated programs. So for example, I had a student interested in, there's a school that offers what she wants to study in fashion, but also in business. And she can graduate with her bachelor's and her MBA in 5 years. And she's like, is that a good deal? Is that what I should be exploring? And I think the question still, you know, so it's definitely cheaper than 6 years of schooling. But the question still is, well, how much debt is that going to require you to take on? And is that workable?
Yeah. Is it prudent and is it workable? That's one of the real kind of sit down and real heartfelt conversations you have to have. Is it A, something that you can do? And is it something that you want to do? Meaning, how much debt are you comfortable taking on? And like you say, sometimes a student has a very different view of that than a parent does. And I think that's when a educational consultant can, kind of find that real conversation that should happen between parents and students.
Absolutely. So what are some additional less common factors or other factors that students may want to consider?
Sure. I think I think those are the ones that I really enjoy kind of digging out and helping a student find out that they are either important or not important. And a lot of times those are the little tidbits that can make a college career, or at least the first 4 years, much more fun and much more enjoyable and much more successful. And a couple of those little things, one to keep in mind is class size. Does a class size really matter to you? And if you need a class size that's 1 to 5 versus, you have a lecture hall of 1 to 750, those are very different things. And if you know that one of those is conducive to you studying and doing well academically, it's really important to identify those. And then, of course, one of the ones that I really think is important is food. and I get in trouble because I use the analogy of, where's the best grilled cheese sandwich on campus and is it available and when? And I use that kind of in a silly way, but a lot of times that's just a way of identifying what kind of food is available and important to a student as well. Mm. And those things actually have a huge psychological impact on students, especially if you're going to be there and you're studying and finals are coming around. Comfort food can be a big deal, and I think that's something that a lot more campuses are starting to identify as well.
That's a great point you raised, because I remember when I used to interview, I had a student ask me, what's the food like? And while I don't know that that's the best question to ask your interviewer, I do understand that it is important, right? And I remember when I first started college, you had to get a meal plan. And my mom was like, oh, you love food. I'm going to get the carte blanche. You can eat anytime you want. And then she realized, and she saw me like maybe 2 months later, and she's like, oh my God, you lost all this weight. And I was like, I hate the food. My mom's like, okay, we're going to change your meal plan ASAP. And I'll give you the money I would have spent on the meal plan, and you're going to learn how to cook. And so ironically, I actually preferred cooking and grocery shopping to eating the food in the cafeteria.
And learned a life skill as well.
Right. Although I never missed out on Chicken Finger Thursdays. There's just certain things you can't miss out on.
So I've got one to ask for you, and it's because I never know how to frame this for students, because it's such a subjective measurement. And that's when you see some of the tools to identify what a school's social life is like. So of course, we always think social life. Does that mean it's a party school, or does it have a Greek system? How do you identify when it says, does it have a good social life? What do you tell students, and how do you frame that?
So I often encourage students to find out what the ratio is of, for example, commuters to students who live on campus or live off campus. Because the more students or percentage that live on campus, it's more likely to have a more active community. But then the resources we also turn to, aside from just visiting a campus, is the FISC guide and also UNIGO. I think they, because they have students who actually talk about, you know, what's it like on campus and how would they describe the culture. And so I feel like that's a really helpful resource in trying to figure out from the students, well, is it a big Greek life? You know, do they have a lot of it, or sports the big thing? So that's what I usually use. But what do you use?
Well, you know, I use the FISC guide. And then I also, I'm lucky enough to have quite a few students who are out there who have either, who are either attending or have recently graduated from. It gives me the, you know, the lowdown and the skinny on what really happens at the school. Because, I mean, even FISC, it's a couple of interviews that they do with students and they pull one or two comments. But the one I really have a hard time with is school spirit. I have no idea, you know, does that mean everybody goes to the
game?
Or does it mean that there's a Greek life? Or does it mean everybody goes to rallies? I don't know. And it's real interesting because if you read in different guides, they have different measurements of school spirit. And for sure, when you ask a student when you're on campus, what's important to one student is not to another. So that one's always tough for me.
That's true. And I also look at how, if I actually get a chance to be on campus, I also look at what's around in terms of activities and flyers and, you know, in terms of what's going on. And I think a lot of what, because I do have students that are like, I can only go to a school that has a lot of school spirit. And usually they're talking about sports. So, you know, for example, I used to live in Ohio and like 15 minutes from OSU. And I just remember game days, no one on the streets. Everyone was watching the game somewhere. So, or like I come from a school that has a lot of school spirit, not for basketball, I mean, for basketball, not for football. And so we even have an organization that's called I Bleed Hoya Blue. So literally we bleed school spirit. So little things like that, I think also give a little bit of a glimpse into what might be popular on campus.
Yep. I think, and some of those things which directly relate to, like you say, when the town is completely dead and everybody's on campus for a game, I think that's an indicator. I think that ties right into one of the things that has become an interesting metric for me is where a school is located relative to a big city. So whether or not, you know, some kids are really interested in being either in a big city and having that kind of experience. But then again, there are schools that are next to or only 20 minutes away from a big city, and it can be a much better academic fit. So I've been spending quite a bit of time working with students to identify that you don't have to be in a city to make use of it.
That is a great point you raise. And even then, like when you look at schools in cities, so you can still identify, well, what kind of campus are you looking at? Because, for example, NYU and Columbia are all in New York City. Or I like to use the example of Georgetown American and George Washington are all in DC. But their campuses are all very different. So, you know, NYU and George Washington, the city is your campus. There is not a lot of green space. So if you're looking for that traditional green space college experience, you know, when they go visit those schools, some of those students are a little disappointed. But at the same time, if you're looking to be like kind of a big kid in a big city, then that's what you'll get. So it varies.
Yeah, when you try to find the green quad of, you know, New York University, it's a little more difficult to find. That's one of the things that I think students who are expecting that when they arrive there are a little bit shocked to find there really isn't one. So, so after you have a whole bunch of these metrics and these characteristics that students have identified and you talked about, are there other ways that you've found that you can start categorizing and using some of the information?
Yes. So I think we talk about it sometimes, but one of the best free resources out there, if they're starting from just, you know, size, setting, major, things like that, clubs or activities, because you might want to continue swimming or, you know, crew at your next school. So you want to check if they have those activities. And I think one of the best resources that I found is Big Future by College Board, the college search section. You literally just plug it in and drag and drop its importance, and it generates a list for you.
Definitely. There's a couple of those search engines that basically use, like you say, they use the metrics we just talked about, and you can identify how important they are to you, whether that you have to have them or that they're good to have. They help generate the schools with some really good updated information. One of the first tools I use before I even go into that, there's a, it used to be called College 101 cards. Now they're called Coursava cards. And Ann Wagner, who's a educational consultant in Seattle, she basically has created this deck of cards that goes over each one of these kinds of metrics and characteristics of schools. And then you can take those cards, and it generates on the on an online online format. It'll generate a list of your must-haves and your absolutely can't-haves, those kind of characteristics. And then you plug them into each one of these things, like Big Future. Are there other ones other than Big Future that you use?
There's another one. I can't think of the name of it. But the other one that I like to use is when there's like more of those, like, for example, where can you get the best grilled cheese kind of lists, I like to use College Express.
College Express. Yes, the grilled cheese. Why does everybody make fun of my grilled cheese?
I'm not making fun of it, Mark. I'm just saying when you're trying to get to the nitty-gritty and, for example, want to know like the best schools to learn video game design, that's where I go.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's one that I've used as well. And like you say, it is good for some of those nuanced components of what a college can bring. Thank goodness I haven't brought up gelato and ice cream yet, because, you know, those are absolutely must-haves, I think, for every student. So I think that there should be a website just for that. I may start that.
I think that'd be great, Mark. I was just thinking, like, you could do a database of all the unique foods for each college. Like, for example, I know for Georgetown, if you go there, we always get a Wisey's Chicken Madness. And so you know you're truly from the area if you go grab that sandwich and people know what you're talking about. But what is, like, something for where you went to school?
Oh, and it's funny because that directly, the University of Washington has one of the best grilled cheese tuna melt sandwiches on the planet. And I know, you know, everybody has their own preferences, but boy, I tell you, as when you're talking comfort food and you're talking things that just are decadent, that was one of my go-tos.
Interesting. I'm not quite sure how I feel about that, but I have never tried a tuna melt, so it's hard to say.
Well, you must have one. So now we've got these tools, we've got these metrics, we've got these characteristics, and now you have to start identifying. If you put them into one of these online tools, and you put in your metrics, you'll mm-hmm. get this big list, and a lot of times it can be as many as 100 schools.
That's true.
If you haven't, you know, brought some certain identifying qualifiers that have some tight constraints. If you don't have those, you'll get a lot of colleges. So how many colleges do you suggest and do you provide the students that you work with?
How many options you mean?
Yeah, how many colleges on their list do you have them start focusing? So you get these qualifiers, and then it starts giving you a whole bunch of colleges, and you go like, well, this college and this college and this college, and then you have a list of 50 colleges, but they're totally, I mean, that's unwieldy. So
that's true.
How many do you try to focus on? How many do you tell students, okay, these are the ones to focus applications on?
I think I don't even get that far usually. So if we start with a list of like 50, let's say, I try to get to 20. And we try to get from 20 down to ideally, I know the IECA recommends 6 to 8 schools. I think it really depends on the student. So how many you think you can handle in terms of creating quality applications, but also depends on the school too, in terms of, because some students I know, they feel like their school district is very competitive. Yep. And 6 to 8 might not be the right number for them. They might have to go a little bit more. But what we do is I find that when they start visiting schools, even if it's local schools that mimic some of the other schools on the list, yep. and they're able to distinguish like, oh, I like that, or, oh, I didn't really enjoy that, then it kind of gives me insight to what other schools they might or might not like, and we can narrow the school list a little further.
Yep. So I have a question for you. When we tell students we should have a list between 6 and 12 schools to focus on, why do we actually have that number? And why don't we only focus on one, or why don't we focus on 50? Why do we try to keep it in that 6 to 10, 6 to 12 range?
Gosh, I wish I knew the answer for that exactly. But I feel like just from experience, that's usually the number in terms of producing, like I said, quality applications, but also for the students to have really found 6 to 12, let's say, schools that they genuinely would enjoy attending. Because if it's much larger than that, then I have to ask, did you really research all the schools enough to really distinguish? Just because I feel like it's like finding your other half, right? I don't know that, you know, you're going to cast such a wide net. And I think it depends, because some students will apply for more, for example, if they don't have that many supplemental essays. But I remember when we had a previous talk with a friend of mine, they originally applied to like 10 safeties and then did a few targets and only 2 reaches. And I was like, okay. And it was because they didn't know anything. They didn't know how many schools to apply to or what that balance is. So sometimes you might need a little guidance, whether it be from your high school guidance counselor or through independence, like you and me.
Exactly. When I tell students that, there are some students who just want to apply to one school. And I know that is not only dangerous, it's actually one of those things where I approach a lot of things. Since I'm a scientist, I approach things from a perspective of what are the percentages, what are the numbers. And the first thing I let, when I start working with a student and we start talking about these lists and applying to schools, I let them know there are no sure things. And that's absolutely important to remember, because otherwise, if you focus on one school, even if you have all the numbers, even if when we do all the searches and it has everything and you are the exact exemplary student of who they've admitted previously, there may be a reason that we don't know you won't get admitted. And if you're applying to only one school, that's a pretty tough thing to swallow. So one of the things I say, you know, we want to decrease your stress and increase your focus on creating really good applications. And one of the best ways to do that is apply to schools that are best for you and you're best for the school. And that's a combination of both things. And if, like you said, if they practice their due diligence, their number of schools is going to be smaller. So when I have that number of schools, it's more or less, I think that 6 to 12 is basically so that when you're playing the numbers, you don't find yourself sitting out a year because you applied to too few schools and didn't get accepted.
That's really great advice. And I think it is important because, like you said, there's factors you can control and then there's factors you really can't control. And, you know, the trends are different each year, and we can talk about that in a little bit. But how do you typically advise your students on how to break out that list? So into what we call like the safety, the likelies, and the stretches.
Well, there again, we hear those terms, the dream school and the reach school, or the target and the match school and the safety schools. And I've always looked at that, and I think because those words are so loaded, cognitively and psychologically, in that they have connotations that reach means I really shouldn't have a chance to go. It's too much of a school for me. And I don't think that's true. I think it's basically, it's you're playing the statistics, the percentages. If this is really a school that you should be going to and should be applying to, it just means that your metrics are maybe not as probable of getting into the school. It doesn't mean that you won't be successful there. It just means your chances of getting in might not be as high as they might be in other schools. And so I've always kind of broke it down into threes, but only because it's kind of looking at it from a percentage base or probability base. How about you? Do you use terms, right? You use specific labels.
I do, but we also try to venture away from saying, reach, for example, because I found that when, you know, not necessarily with me, but like with high school guidance counselors, that'll say that sometimes with my students, it'll send them into a frenzy in terms of like panic mode, like, oh my gosh, like I won't get in and, you know, so on and so forth. Whereas I think it's, like you said, a bit healthier to approach it from the idea that statistically speaking, you have a higher chance of getting in if it's like, you know, a safety school. But, you know, for if you land in the middle of the 50% band for scores and GPA, then, you know, you still have like a 50-50 chance is what I would say of getting in. And then you have some schools that either maybe you're at the closer to the bottom of the 50% band or their rate of admissions is just so low that, you know, it's hard to say who they'll accept. So those are maybe the stretches. So that's how we typically approach it. It's not like you said, it's not saying you can't get in. It's just saying, if we look at the odds, they might, you know, they just work out a certain way.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's one thing to keep in mind, that all of the schools, depending on if they are a high percentage, low percentage, or right on the middle percentage, to remember that you are applying to schools that are appropriate. And that they match your criteria, and you match their criteria, their acceptance criteria. And I think if you keep that in mind, then you don't have your heart ripped out when you have your focus on just one school, and for some reason you don't get in. And I think that's really stressful, and it's not a good way to spend your senior year thinking about, am I going to get into this one school? And I think that's really unhealthy. So I try to let students know that that's not the best approach for sure.
And what would you say? Like, I think it's so important that students understand that it's not them necessarily. And I think there was a really great MIT blog article that came out around the time that Decisions rolled out, trying to help students understand that it's not personal. You know,
right.
It wasn't necessarily that they lacked in something, or, you know, it's just, there's a set number of spaces. And so, you know, why don't we talk a little bit about what are some factors that students have no control over?
Yeah, there's the things that you can control and the things that you can't. And there's are also those things that you have absolutely no idea of some of the forces that are at play that you actually have no control over. And I think a big part of those are just, and they change from year to year and from school to school. And if you talk to admissions directors and people who work in admissions, they'll tell you that their years change dramatically and the characteristics of who's applying every year. So that is also part of the equation. And so I think one of the big things that students don't realize is the absolute number of applicants per year has a huge impact on who is going to actually eventually or ultimately be accepted.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And in addition to the number of them, you don't know what each of them brings to the table too.
That's right. You don't know what are the characteristics of the applicant pool. Then you've got also all the applications are in and they're being read. They're being read by human beings. Some of them actually use certain metric levels at which there's a certain benchmark that you have to make before they even get evaluated. So there might be an SAT score level that you have to achieve before your application is seriously considered. So that's one of the things, if it makes it to that level. But then you've got a human being who's reading them, or multiple human beings who are often reading them, and they are subjective. Is even if they want to be objective, they are still subjective and biased. And that's one of the, like you say, it's not personal, but that's part of the things that you can't control.
You're absolutely right. But now that we've talked about what they can't control, what are some things that they can control and put their best foot forward on?
These are the ones students don't like to hear about because then it puts the onus on them. And I think that's one of the things that they have absolute control over their GPA. Do they choose to study or watch Netflix? And, their SAT score, did they choose to study for it before? Did they choose to take it a second time and study in between? Those are within their power. Did they start their essay early and did they get proof, multiple drafts done? And I think those are things they totally have control over, and they're such a huge part of the application that if they don't take control of those, it puts them at a very large disadvantage when the things that they can't control, like the size of the application pool. So they want to make sure that they do all the things they can on the things that they know about.
That's a great point. And I remember I was at an information session and the admissions representative had said, like, they really look they focus on the essays a lot because they think that that's one of the factors that the students does have direct control over. And they had said that the student doesn't have control over recommendations, but in actuality, you do. It depends on the time and effort you have, spent into building those relationships with your teachers and your coaches and the people writing these recommendations for you, including your guidance counselor. So, these are all things that are still within your control.
I'm so glad you brought up the recommendation letter because it's one of those things that schools have talked about your application being a full story. It should be a supported and continuous story about who you are and basically what you've done up to this point. And I think one of the big parts that they say is often missing from an application are good recommendations, or that they don't support what are said in other parts of the application. So I absolutely believe a student can help teachers, and having been a teacher and having written thousands of recommendation letters, I can tell you that if a student takes the time, like you say, to develop the relationship, which takes a long period of time, it can only take one class, but it has to be something that is developed over time. And then they also, I give students a brag sheet or a resume template, and basically they go and formally ask a teacher to write a letter of recommendation, and the brag sheet says why they should, and it gives them some examples that they can use that directly support the rest of their application. So I think the recommendation letter is something they have a lot of power over how good it actually is written.
You do. The only thing is you just don't get to see it. That's the only thing. You have control. You just don't get to see it.
Absolutely. I think that's one of the things that it can be frustrating, but I think it's also one of those things that if you're having the right person write the recommendation, you pretty much know what kind of things they're going to say anyway.
That's a great point. So what happens when you have students that have huge lists and you have to narrow it down to the final list that they're going to apply to?
Oh, that's one of those things where, you know, there's 50 schools that got generated and how do you start narrowing them down? I think there's two methods that come to mind. One of them I learned from a student who is a basketball fan. And the other one is one that I think most people use, and that's a filter method. Basically, you start with your most restrictive characteristics, things like size, things like what kind of acceptance rates, those things that restrict your pool rather quickly. Start mm-hmm. with those first and start narrowing your pool down. But then there's also the final four bracket technique, and that's the one I learned from somebody who was a basketball fan, and he basically applied the brackets of the final four, the Sweet 16, and basically you identify the colleges and you give them characteristics just like players, and then you have them play off each other and you say, these are the characteristics, who's going to win, who's going to get my, who's going to create the best academic environment for me over the 4 years, and basically they came up with this bracket system where it came down to a number of 16 schools who finally made it to the playoffs. And those are the ones he applied to.
Oh, I love that. I haven't heard of that technique before, but I am definitely going to try to see if I can utilize that, even though I don't follow basketball quite that well.
Yeah, just build a team.
Yes. So what are some additional factors I think that students want to think about when they narrow down their lists? For example, I have some students who have severe test anxiety, and that's not easily conquerable. But, you know, they might do really great in school, though. So we'll always explore some test optional schools in addition, and there are lists and there's a website for that by itself. But are there any others that you think are more non-conventional?
Absolutely. I think that test optional one is a really important one, and I think that's one of those restrictive filters that you apply to your brackets or your filters. And one of the ones that when we've talked about this previous podcast, is early action. If a school has the ability or they have the opportunity for you to apply early and get accepted early, and you can make that decision and have the rest of your senior year to enjoy, schools which have accept applications as early as November 1st or November 15th. And I think that's one of the things that I have additionally added to the filter system.
That's a great point. And actually, there are some schools that go a little further than early action and actually do rolling. And so I know some students that really want to know kind of where they are in terms of landing and their safety, so on and so forth. They'll do like a rolling. And if you do it early enough, I've had students that I've found out within like a week to 2 weeks, their admissions decision. So even before November.
Yeah, for those schools that have that opportunity and that's the way that they like to do applications. I think I wish it was that way for all schools, and I think that would be one of the biggest ways to take off some of the stress from students and so that they can focus on their academics of their senior year as well. But rolling admissions is such a unique thing, and I think more colleges are actually looking at it as a healthy thing to do as well.
It really is. And it's also good for the colleges, too, in that they really can see which students are organized and passionate about attending their schools enough to get their applications done in a timely manner.
Yep, I think you're right. One of the things, one of those additional filters that has come up recently, especially with the students I'm working with this year, and that's political climate on the school campus and talking with a lot of admits from last year, students I worked with either last year or the previous 2 years, talking to them about the political climate of their campus at this time. And I think that's one of the things that I think students are more interested in that than ever before.
That's a great factor you bring up. And I think part of it also, in addition to political climate, is I'm going to bring up diversity.
Yep.
And how accepting and open campuses are to people of different backgrounds. I know that that has also come up with the political climate as well, in terms of, is a student going to feel safe at certain schools around the country?
Yep. I think that's one of the things that I've, and I have to be very careful. I mean, I think all consultants, when we work with kids, we try not to bring our own biases to the evaluations of schools. But I think that's one of the things when I go visit a campus and I talk with students and professors, I immediately start asking questions about diversity and how it's handled on campus. And do students of all backgrounds, do they feel safe when they're on campus? And it's interesting. You get different answers to that than would initially show up in some of the resources, especially online and that. You actually have to ask students and professors to get the real story.
That's a great point. But, you know, I would also venture to say, I know some students were concerned. For example, like, you'll see stuff in the news, and I just want to say, like, sometimes those incidents are usually isolated, so I would still encourage students to check out certain schools, even though they might be in the media for things that you might not, that might seem scary, because those incidents are isolated.
Exactly, and I think that's one of the things when those kind of things happen on a campus, a lot of times the school takes a very deep look at why it happened and put it in place. At least we like to believe that they do, and I think most of them do that.
I would agree. They definitely do. So let's end on happy notes. What are some crazy questions? Let's throw out there.
So I'm always curious how other consultants talk students through some of this process. And so let's say you've got a student who has a 2.9 GPA and their SAT is 1000, but they only want to talk about Ivy League schools. So how do you approach putting their schools and those metrics into reality?
So I am a very honest consultant and very straightforward, as my families have figured out. I don't beat around the bush, so to speak. So there are consultants that will say, yeah, we can get you in, and then they take all your money. And I don't think that is good practice necessarily. And so what I usually say is I like to review the numbers with them and just say, okay, here is the 50% bracket in terms of average standardized test scores and GPA, and this is where your GPA lands. And, you know, hopefully that is a refresher. And it usually either, depending on where they are in the process, incentivizes them to work harder or understand that we might have to add to their list. And, you know, really hitting home that I really want to make sure you have a home to go to next fall. And, you know, let's explore some additional options that might also be a good fit for you. Because I think it's really important for us as guidance counselors, as consultants, and even in the media to hammer home that, you know, picking a school by name is not necessarily the way you want to go, or by rank.
For sure. For sure. I think you might be even nicer than I am. I usually try to be as nice as possible, but I've run into that a few times, and usually my response is no. And then I sit down and I do the calculation and show that your chances of getting in are less than 3%, you know, that kind of thing. And then just try to have a real conversation. Like you say, here's the reason why. Let's see if we can't expand on that list a little bit more for sure. So Ivy League, since we touched on that just a little bit, I think this is real common where students only believe Ivy League schools are the only institutions to apply to. What do you do to try to even start that conversation about maybe taking a look a little bit more broadly?
So first of all, I like to explain what the Ivy League is. So they are great schools, but they're called the Ivy League because they happen to be the oldest schools in our country. And, you know, that doesn't necessarily mean that that's the best school for what they want to study or for their personal development and growth. So, you know, if you're an engineering student, the Ivy League is great, but, you know, maybe you should also look if you're like super competitive at MIT and Caltech and Georgia Tech. Schools that are really going to help you succeed. So I think and then I also point out the statistic that, you know, only, I think it's 0.4% of the student population attend the Ivy League. So, you know, the odds are not necessarily there. So it's always good to explore schools that are also similar. Also, all the Ivies are in very cold areas. So I want you to make sure you're okay with that. Because I had a student that was interested in applying to Cornell, but hated cold weather and really wanted to be somewhere warm. And I was like, and they were from out of this country. And I was like, I just want to let you know, it is freezing over there. I don't think you're going to be happy there. And so later on in the process, you know, they ended up applying for Rice University too in UCLA. And they're like, why did I apply early decision to Cornell? They're like, thank God I got rejected.
I hadn't thought of that. You bring up one thing. I've never thought of what if there was an Ivy League in Hawaii? You
know? I'd totally apply. I'd want to go there.
I had never thought of that. That would be one of those interesting. It's funny you brought up the old, they're old schools. And I think that is actually one of the ways that I've immediately ask a student, so what you're saying is you want to go to an old school. And they say, no, I want to go to a good school. And I said, oh, so what you're saying is MIT is not a good school for science. And they look at you and they think you've lost your mind because I said, well, MIT is not an Ivy League school. And they say, well, that's not what I meant. And that's that usually opens up the conversation pretty quickly.
I agree. And you'd be surprised. A lot of people will think certain schools are Ivy when they're not.
Yeah. That's for sure. Or some schools claim to be just as good as Ivy Leagues, which in a lot of cases they are, but it's funny that they have to use that label as a identifier of quality, for sure.
So touching upon that, what are some unorthodox reasons that you have heard from students for them picking their schools?
Oh, why unorthodox, why they're picking them?
Yeah, like certain schools that they definitely don't want on the list or they do want on the list. Like, what are some unorthodox characteristics that you see?
Wow. I mean, some of the unorthodox, well, this is, I had somebody who said they would never go to a school that had a Quidditch team.
Oh, my God.
So I don't know if they meant that was directly related to the social activities that were commonplace on campus or not, but they would never go to a school that had a Quidditch team. So that was a weird one.
That definitely is. I've had students who I think visited Bowdoin in Maine, I think it is. And so they serve lobster there. And they're like, wow, they serve lobster in their cafeteria. I should go.
Well, I mean, the thing is, I think there are a lot of people who would apply to Bowdoin, but they can't spell it. And that's the problem. I think that's if they would have that on their list of schools, but nobody can find it because it's not spelled the way that you initially would think. And I think that's a big detriment to the school.
That's a great point. I wonder if anyone hears us from Bowdoin, you know, just a shout out that, you know, help us out with the spelling. So, you know, we talk about the grilled cheese sandwiches, and like I told you, my favorite chicken sandwich from the Georgetown area. How important do you stress your students in terms of these comfort foods when they create their list?
And that's the thing. I think it is one of the underdogs of psychological health is comfort food. And especially, you know, when it's midterms and finals and you are up and it's 2 o'clock in the morning and you just need something to keep you positive and keep your mind on what you're doing. Sometimes, you know, having a direct line to a good ice cream can make all the difference. And I think that's, I actually do make it one of those things that I ask students how important it is, because I do ask that when I'm on campus.
That's a great point. And I have a random story, but I actually bonded with one of my roommates once over ice cream. I had moved back to campus halfway through the year. So I was with a roommate I had never met before, not from here. They were on exchange. And we hadn't really hit it off, but I walked in one time and they were really upset about something. And another friend of mine had seen me when I was really upset after a class once, just because it was an acting class, ironically, and I had just really messed up on my monologue, and they dropped off ice cream. So off I went to go to the Ben and Jerry's store to pick up a tub of ice cream and dropped it off with my roommate. And that's actually how our friendship started.
And there are friendships that have been bonded over ice cream for millennia. So I think that's one of those important things to remember, that food can be one of the great, it can introduce a conversation that normally wouldn't happen. So I think it is an important thing that isn't taken as seriously as it could be.
And then are there ever times where you, because, you know, we said 6 to 12. But I've had guidance counselors in high schools tell my students that they should apply to over 20 schools. So I'm going to ask you, is there ever a time when you think students should apply to more than 15 schools?
No, I really don't. And the reason being, and I think that's one of the great things that a good educational consultant can bring to the table for a student, is identifying those schools that are right for them and they're right for those schools. And I think if you do that and you do your research and you practice due diligence, you will actually come up with a set of schools that are really going to be your best opportunity at being successful over 4 years and having a really good educational opportunity.
I think I totally agree with you. So when they said that, I was like, no, we're not applying for 20 schools. We're not even applying for 15.
Yeah,
I was like, do they know you're taking all AP classes senior year?
Yeah, exactly. That's the reality of, it's a lot of work. And there are, I mean, between the coalition application and common app ability to apply to quite a few schools, it's a lot easier than it used to be, but boy, it's still not easy.
Absolutely. It still takes time and effort to craft different parts of the application. And then there are applications that are not on coalition or common app that require more time too, and that are still worth it though.
Which is even more time on top of that. And like you said, if you're taking, you know, 3 AP classes and trying to do it all, there's just so many hours in a day, and you still need a couple hours for sleep.
Yes. And for fun.
And fun.
So what is your closing advice to our audience on this topic?
You bet. There are no sure things. And that's one thing I think, as soon as students understand there are no sure things and that you're playing probabilities, don't get your heart set on one school. That will probably be the best thing you can do for your psychological health that there is.
That's great advice. And I would say keep an open mind. So in terms of thinking, oh, I only want this school, the more schools you visit, you'd be surprised at how you are further able to refine what you're looking for in a school in terms of some place where you'll really grow, not just academically, but personally as well.
And hopefully not waistline-wise, because ice cream is so good.
And on that note, thank you so much, Mark.
Thank you, Anna.
Thanks for listening to the Coast to Coast College Admissions Podcast, where we make getting into college easy and fun. Don't forget to go over to iTunes and subscribe to get updated each week when we release a new episode. Also, for more helpful college admissions information, visit our website at www.c2ccollegepodcast.com.